So I've called this talk Introducing Ethics, Resonating with Reality. I just find it so interesting giving talks about the Dharma because it's like, I think I'm just always so aware of how it's like I just sort of think in boxes. It's like we think in certain categories. And what the Dharma's trying to get us to do is say, look, it's just not like that. You know, come at everything sideways, think in a different way. I'm just always so aware of how the fact that, like, you know, it's like I'm talking from a position of delusion, if you see what I mean, and I'm trying to express something that is outside of delusion. And there's always this sense of tension at trying to do that. So I'm going to start off by telling you the story of Angulimala. And I'm sure you all know the story of Angulimala, and that completely doesn't matter. So, this is after the Buddha's been enlightened for about 20 years, and he's been sort of wandering around northern India for 20 years and talking to farmers and kings and prostitutes and mothers and widows and beggars, and he's just kind of like walking around and seeing, you know, by who he is, can he benefit the people that he comes across? And sometimes it totally changes them, and sometimes they just think, don't know what you're on, and they just carry on in their usual way. So on this occasion, the Buddha hears that there's a bandit terrorizing a neighborhood, and this bandit is called Angulimala, and he's called that Anguli Fingers because he wears around his neck the bloody little finger of all his victims. He cuts off the little fingers and he kind of hangs them in a trophy around his neck. And villages are being abandoned and towns are being abandoned because people don't feel safe. People they know have died. It's not okay to live in that region because they are going to get murdered if they stay there. And the Buddha wanders into this area and everyone that he comes across is saying, don't go that way, you will get killed, it's not safe. And you know, he just meets person after person who says, don't take that road. And the Buddha just thanks them and carries on taking that road. And so there he goes, you know, sort of like right into the area of Angulimala. And Angulimala sees him, and he sees him on the road, and he thinks, is this man crazy? You know, people don't come this way anymore unless they're in kind of like groups of 40 armed men to protect themselves. And even then, sometimes I manage to kill them. And now this monk comes all by himself, walking along this road. What does he think he's doing? Great, there's another finger. There's my 100th finger. So he starts in pursuit of Angulimala. And first he's walking and the Buddha is walking. And he doesn't seem to be catching him. And then he walks faster. And still he doesn't seem to be catching him, although the Buddha's just walking at his ordinary, slow, mindful pace. And then Angulimala starts like charging along the road at top speed. And even though he's running as fast as he can, and it seems like the Buddha is just walking at his ordinary pace, Angulimala cannot catch up the Buddha. And, you know, you can just imagine his frustration. It's just like, I'm used to this. You know, I do this sort of thing all the time. Why can't I catch him? Like, what's going wrong? And in the end, he just stops in the road and he just shouts and he shouts, stop, monk, stop. And the Buddha doesn't stop, but he says, I have stopped. I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too. And this is just, I find this interaction just completely fascinating because Then Angulimala, he has this, he kind of thinks to himself, well, hang on a sec. What do you mean you've stopped? I've stopped. You haven't stopped. You're still walking. What are you talking about? You know, this is a load of rubbish. But also something happens where he thinks, oh, these sons of the Shakyans, these followers of the Buddha, they speak truth. They assert truth. And so it's like he has this sort of trust response where he does think, oh, well, if the Buddha's saying that, there must be something in it. And it's, so what, you know, what is that, that he has a trust response? And then the Buddha says, I have stopped. I have stopped harming all living beings. I live by the principle of loving kindness. I don't kill or harm anyone or anything. But you have not stopped. You're murderous and bloody-handed, and you have no compassion on anything that lives. That is why I have stopped and you have not stopped. And then Angulimala, you know, and you sort of think, what is going on here? Like, what is going on? Because then Angulimala says, oh, at last, someone has come who I can respect. And he goes for refuge to the Buddha and says, can I practice the Dharma? This is what I've been looking for all my life. Can I practice the Dharma? So it's like he has this faith response where, you know, he's obviously been like, you know, who knows why he thinks mass murdering is a good way to live. but he's been living in a certain way. And yet when he has this encounter with the Buddha, he realises that him living for, like, what he can get, pillaging, looting, raping, killing, actually, in his depths, like, in his heart of heart, that isn't what he wants. And you get this thing where it's like, the Buddha's presence is very powerful. So, like, we just get the words transmitted to us, but what we don't get is what the effect of someone who is fully living, aligned with enlightenment, what sort of effect that has on the people they meet. So, yeah, you get the Buddha and Angulimala coming together, and then he realises this is what he wants. How he's been living unethically, that isn't going to do it. And this man who's come along this road, he is modelling what Angulimala has really wanted all along. And then, I mean, I just love all the detail in the Pali Canon. I love it. And so then you get the king. So the Buddha sort of returns with Angulimala, sort of walking next to him, and Angulimala puts on the robes of one of the Buddha's followers, these sort of dirty rag robes, and starts practicing meditation, and actually, you know, and he's sitting down, cross-legged, probably doing the mindfulness of breathing. And then what happens? The king rocks up with his whole army, with 500 men on horses, with swords and spears, and they're come to try and capture Angulimala. And the king's terrified, and he's saying, we've got to try and do it because, you know, this is causing havoc. But, you know, I don't think we're going to manage it. You know, him and his men, they're going to beat us. And the Buddha says, well, hang on a sec. What would you do if you discovered that this mass murderer that had been killing all these people in your land was now one of my followers and was practicing peace and awareness and kindness? And the king, you can kind of see him going, and he sort of says, well, I mean, I suppose I'd treat him with respect and, you know, give him food and robes and medicine like I do the rest of your followers, but, you know, that's never going to happen. I mean, this man is a, you know, he's a robber, he's a murderer. And he says he has evil for his ideal. He says, that's never going to happen. This man has evil for his ideal. And then the Buddha kind of like turns around and says, meet Angulimala. and, you know, points to this chap who looks exactly like one of the other Buddha's followers meditating and says, this is now Angulimala. And the king gives him a new name, because he says, well, who's your mother, who's your father? And he stops calling him Bloody Fingers and starts calling him son of whoever it is, daughter of whoever it is. And the Buddha says, now he's taken good for his ideal. Taken good for his ideal. And then you don't get a huge amount of detail, but that turnaround for Angulimala, it was serious. So it's like he gets this moment of vision where he meets the Buddha, and this vision appears to him of like, it could be different. I could be different. The effect I have on the world could be different. So he gets this vision where it's like, it could be different. And in a way, like, all of us, well, if we haven't become a Mitra yet, we've asked to become a Mitra. All of us asked to become a Mitra and then made that commitment. And there will have been some sort of vision where we've thought, it could be different. Oh, look, there's a possibility here, there's a potential here, if I step into it. But then if Angulimala had just had this kind of like, nah, look, it could be amazing, and then he hadn't then done the transformation. So then what he does is he goes away and he takes his practice really seriously. And actually, I think there's a certain advantage. I mean, if anybody's come from really, really painful, difficult situations, like some people do and some people don't, but if you have come from a really seriously painful or difficult situation, you know how bad it is, so then you've got very, very strong motivation to turn it around. In a way, it's kind of harder to practice, you know, if samsara basically is working okay for you. You know, it might be a bit better around the edges, but, you know, if you're sort of basically okay, it's much harder to be in touch with, like, oh, and there could be so much more, like, you know, it's much easier to have a bit of a sort of cap on where we want to go. So Angulimala would not have had that, because I don't think the experience of being a mass murderer internally is a happy one. Personally, I feel this unlikely. So Angulimala will be highly motivated. And so then he does practice ethics, meditation, wisdom. He turns it around. He sees his own nature, his interconnectedness, you know, no separation between world and him. And he does become enlightened. He does become enlightened. And he does still have... I wasn't going to go on to this bit, but anyway. But he does still have this bit, you know, even after he's enlightened and he goes into a village. And it doesn't really explain things that much in the Pali Canon, but villagers throw things at him, like clods and rocks and pots. And you don't know if it's because they know he's an ex-mass murderer, which would be, you know, not a natural response, possibly. Mm-hmm. Or whether it's, you know, there's some other circumstance. But he comes back and his robe's torn and he's bleeding and he's probably a bit concussed and, you know, and he says to the Buddha, what's happened? And the Buddha just says, bear it, brother, bear it. It's like, these are consequences of your actions. But basically, like, if those are the only consequences of your actions that you're going to be experiencing, like, hey, you've got nothing to worry about. Because... actually, he has managed to transform his consciousness to such an extent. You know, it's like, even though he was as evil as anybody could be, if you're using that language, total transformation was possible. And so it is for us. Ha ha. Right, where am I going now? So it's like the whole of the Buddhist path is about change and how to change, how to go about doing that. And like I must say, so I've been practicing the Dharma for 12 years, and I've been at Taraloka for 9 years. And actually, it's like, if you'd met me 12 years ago, you would not know that I was the same person. Like, sometimes I kind of go, oh my God, who am I? I just don't even recognise who I am compared to how I used to be. Mm. And sometimes it's much... And I think I can see it over 12 years, but if I look at, like, last year, I probably can't really see it. And quite often it's easier to see transformation in other people. Like, you can really see how other people change, and it's kind of can be harder to see how we change. So, so we're looking at this whole area of vision and transformation, and I mentioned that last night in terms of this quote of Padmasambhava about keeping a mind as vast as the sky, and yet our conduct being as fine as grains of flour, and how both of those aspects are really, really important. Because, well, I mean, so I think people actually kind of like fit how people experience these different areas of vision and transformation. It's quite, I think it's, you know, people have different balances. So some of us, it's like we'll be big vision types. I'm a big vision type. And it could be that, like, you know, it's like some sort of possibility like arises, like, and it could, and it could be, so for me it was meditation, puja, you know, sort of classic Buddhist practice, and I just come along and my mind would just go kapow. And for some people it's like they've had those sort of experiences maybe when they've been walking along a beach at sunset, or they've been in a wilderness area, or maybe they've just given birth and they're looking at their new baby. Or do you see what I mean? It's like it's possible to like have these actually art or music can take people into these kind of like very, very big expansive experiences where it just feels like everything is connected, everything is magical. You can really feel how like the nature of everything is love, or the nature of everything is awareness. So some people are like that. But then what happens if it's just like there's a kind of like la, there's this sort of big vision, and then actually we then don't live it, we then don't do the transformation part and take it into our lives. And I used to find that very, very painful when I first started practicing, that it's like I'd meditate and I'd just have all these sort of lovely expansive states, and oh, isn't it all gorgeous? And I would stand up off the meditation cushion and, you know, ill will, craving, speaking badly of other people, just wanting to, I don't know, eat chocolate and surf the internet. You know, it's like I couldn't live what was happening in meditation, and that was very, very painful. And basically, if we don't find ways of living that vision or that connection, the vision will go. It's like the transformation has to happen. And then as we transform, it's like more vision happens. So some people are on that end of the spectrum. Other people are on another end of the spectrum, which is more like kind of next steps people. So it's like the vision is much smaller. So it might be we go along to a Buddhist centre and we think, oh, I like it here. These people seem to be a bit different. Like there's something going on here. Or perhaps we start meditating and we realise that actually it has a positive impact on our lives, on our relationships. Maybe we go on a day retreat and we think, oh yeah, that seemed good. What's my next step? And so it's like the vision is more like, oh, this seems good so far. Can I take the next step into it? And it's the same process where it's like vision arises and then there has to be the transformation. But those people are much sort of steadier, much more kind of like, you know, you make progress one step at a time. like they're just different ways of engaging. It's not like one's better. I mean, actually, I quite envy next step people. Actually, I kind of go, oh, I'd just love to be steady like that. And of course, there it's like it's just as important to have the vision, because if we have no vision of how things could be different, of how amazing it could be, there's no motivation to do the transformation. There's no motivation to change. So for ethics, we need the vision. We need to know why we're doing these things. And then we need to do the transformation, which is the actual, like, on the ground, living it. So I'm taking here quite a big perspective on ethics. So we can include under ethics the whole, actually, of the threefold path. So wisdom, interconnectedness. We can, when we're consciously practicing ethics, we're deliberately choosing to behave as if we had a wisdom perspective, as if we were a Buddha. So it includes wisdom, and that's the staying in touch with the vision aspect. It includes meditation. So meditation is action with the mind, and we're cultivating ethical mental states of awareness and kindness. So meditation, definitely, it's definitely ethical, it's skillful to meditate. And then we're also including the ethics aspect in the sense of allowing the values that we live by to influence every aspect of our daily lives. So that's like our choices in the moment. Can we choose to live by the vision, our values that we've that we want to? Okay, so next I'm going to talk about conditionality and karma and how ethics is fitting into this whole thing. So, which end shall I take this from? So when we're talking about ethics, we are talking about this whole realm of karma, which I have to say, in general English usage, is much misunderstood. But hopefully, because we all come from good Buddhist centres, we won't have those misunderstandings, but I'm going to clear them up nonetheless. I must say, actually, I love listening to Banti's early lectures because you can just hear that, like, he just knows that everybody's just going to be totally muddled with this kind of, like, Californian New Agey kind of hippie stuff. And he's just talking to everybody that, he just thinks, you're not going to have a clue. You know, he sort of knows they're not going to be grounded. Whereas, like, nowadays, I think people have got a much, much higher chance of actually being grounded in, sort of genuine Buddhist principle. Yes. So, this is all part of the Buddha's central teaching of conditionality. I just end up kind of wanting to jump around and dance around about conditionality, and I don't quite know why, but it's just so exciting. The whole thing is exciting. So, I've got a list up. And again, you may well have come across these, which is a good thing. So, the reason that we are looking here at the five niyamas is, well, basically because we won't understand it if we don't. So we're going to. Good. Yes. So when we're talking about ethics, we're talking about like one aspect of how cause and effect works in the universe. And we're just talking about one aspect of it. So the Buddha actually got asked this question. So somebody walked up to the Buddha and said, does karma produce everything that happens to us? And the Buddha said, no, which is quite clear. And he doesn't go into it in terms of the five niyamas, but he sort of says, well, no, of course it doesn't. You know, you know, something's happened because of the wind element or the bile element, or, you know, he goes into a few things. So basically, like, what he's kind of getting at is karma is one reason, you know, it's like it's one aspect of how things happen, but it's only one aspect. And that's a very, very important thing to keep hold of. So we've got the word karma, which simply means action. And it's talking about our conscious volitional choices. And it's at a level where we are self-aware. So we're aware of, like, here's me, Maitri Siddhi, sat in this chair. Here's Helen, sat next to me.
Oh, I'm listening.
It's all right, I know you're listening. You're just featuring in my talk, that's all. And here's Helen sat next to me, and she's, you know, and she's another person. And choices that I make will affect Helen, will affect Anne or Sahajtara. So it comes from a level of awareness. Now, how the Buddha described how things arise, how reality is he described it as a niyamata, which means ordered. So things arise not randomly, but in dependence on conditions. And then later tradition, which then gets taken up and described by Sangharajita, talks about things in terms of these five niyamas, which I quite like because, well, they just make things very, very clear. So you've got Uchi niyama. So you've got... Hello, Helen?
No, I was going to have to spell that by...
Niyamas.
Yeah, niyamas, right, sorry, yeah.
Great, okay, got it? Great, good. I think people do say it in different ways. So. Yeah. So you've got Utu Niyama, so that's basically, it's like the laws of physics and chemistry. So, you know, if I drop my watch, the watch falls on the floor. So things like gravity, you know, chemistry. If you make a cup of tea and you stir tea in boiling water, the tea dissolves in the boiling water, you know, things like that. And that's nothing to do with karma. That's nothing to do with ethical choices, is it? And then we've got biology. So I had a chest infection last week, and I imagine that was something to do with the bacteria that got in my lungs. So that is much more likely to be to do with the fact that, like, you know, I am a physical human being. There are biological processes that go on in me. And sometimes I get ill, and, you know, it's bacteria, and they're having their life, and sometimes they decide to do it in my lungs, which is inconvenient, but that's another matter. And again, you can see that that's got nothing to do with ethical choices. Then we've got instinctual consciousness, and you can see how it's like we're rising in level of consciousness as it goes up. So instinctual consciousness is things like, well, we get hungry and we need to eat. We get thirsty and we need to drink. I mean, I find it a very, very interesting... like these, they don't have clear boundaries, these. It's more like you can see how each level kind of blends into the one above it. Because, for instance, we've got two cats. They're feral and they live in the garage. And my goodness, the number of things that they kill... so it's like, you know, they're forever bringing in kind of like disemboweled squirrels and, you know, I don't know, all sorts. But actually, like, in a way, that is instinctual consciousness. Mm. It's like they are cats. Cats are predators. You know, a cat is not really capable of having empathy for a mouse. It's not able with its level of consciousness to think, this mouse is alive as I am alive. This mouse does not want to be eaten just as I don't want to be eaten. You know, a cat is not capable of that level of thinking. And so then we get onto, onto karma, onto ethical choice and ethical awareness. So as I've said, you know, that's where the level at which we become able to make self-conscious choices. But even as humans, it's like, you can meet people where you think, this person is functioning on a mano-niyama level. It's like actually they don't have a level of awareness of what's going on, and they just don't have the resources to be able to make ethical choice. And yet every human, when they are resourced enough, compassion and empathy is natural in the human state. So it's like we are all capable of making choices at that level where we see, here am I. I have agency. What I do affects other beings, other people, the world I live in. And then we can choose what do I want to do here? What else do I need to say about karma? Yes, so this whole area, this is how the choices we make are determining how our mind arises in the future. So this karma one, like this is just so important, because this is the one where transformation can happen. Because if you think about it, like these first three physical ones, it's like, okay, we can, it's important to take them into consideration. Like, it's important to, eat a good diet, make sure we drink enough. Do you see what I mean? It's like, it's not that we should ignore those by any means. But nonetheless, this karma niyama, this is the one that makes it possible for us to transform. This is the one where we have agency over who we become. And then by who we become, the effect that we then have in the world. So this is where the Buddha says, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an unskillful mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one thinks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. Okay, the shadow that never departs. You have to think really hot weather, yeah, like last month. Where, like, actually, if you could walk around with a shadow that never departs, that's a really good thing. But probably normally in our climate, we might think of a ray of sunshine that never departs. A bit more probably. Yeah. I've got too many directions I want to go. Okay. It's funny, I think I've said the facts about that, but I think what I haven't communicated is just how radical that is. That, by I always talk about snapping at people because I think it's something that I do a lot, but it's like by the choices that I make, I am choosing who I become next year, 10 years time. And it's like, so what we're working on with karma is what gets called our chetana. Just write it up here. And that means our volitions or will. And it's like the whole directionality of our mind. And of course it's like, you can't change that all at once. I mean, I go walking in Snowdonia quite a lot, and you just have these kind of like, you know, you've got these mountain ridges and then these valleys, and you can see how the water over years, over centuries, has carved these, you know, these streams and these river valleys out into the mountain. And of course, then when it rains, well, where does the water run? It goes, you know, straight into these habit grooves, these streams. And of course, it's just the same with our minds. It's like we have a particular topography. You know, we have a mountainside and river valleys where, you know, our volitions naturally run in the same direction. So then, it's as simple as habit, but that is just totally radical. Like every time we do a kind action, every time we decide to act out a kind thought instead of a mean one, we're creating that river valley, we're creating that directionality in our minds. Every time we meditate, like, who was it that said last night, oh, it doesn't matter just this once? I think it might have been Anne. And it's like, well, can we think just this once? Can I do the skillful thing just this once? And that will create this positive habit. And then that means next time that that habit of love, or that, you know, that natural inclination of love will arise. So let's just get these sort of key areas of, like, so what makes Buddhist ethics different from any others? Oh no, I've forgotten one of the niyamas. I can't do that. It's the most important one.
Yes. What are you doing?
That's shocking. Look, how can we do that? Great. Okay, so we've got Dharma niyama. Oh my goodness. Yeah, so okay, so on karma niyama, it's like there's us as agent. And by us doing skillful actions of love, kindness, and awareness, what happens is we transform our mind enough that we become receptive to Dharma niyama processes. And so this Dharma niyama, so this is Sangharakshita's interpretation. I'm not sure it's quite like this in the source he's taken it from, but actually he is describing, how he's describing it makes sense in my experience. So we do this kind of like, I am a moral agent and I can change myself. And then what happens is it's like something else meets us in the universe. So practicing ethics, that's like we're swimming out. So there's this vast river. If anyone's ever been anywhere with like a really big river where you can, you know, you can't even see the other shore, it's like, so we're swimming out into the river, and at the edge, you know how if you chuck a stick in a river, it just drifts naturally to the edge if it's not too far in. But if you chuck a stick right in the middle of a river, well, the current takes it, doesn't it? And the current just takes it all the way to the ocean. So that's like this kind of like relationship between karma niyama and dharma niyama. So with karma niyama, we're trying to swim out from the, we're trying to get off the edge of the stream. We're trying to swim out, and we can only do that under our own power. Like, nothing else can do that for us. We have to want to do that. We have to see why it's worth it. And then what happens is it's like slowly we can just feel this current start to take us. And I mean, it's just like magic. And like, so some people in this room will completely know what I'm talking about, and other people might be just sitting there thinking, no, I don't know what she's on about. So don't worry if you're one of those people. Just keep going. Just keep swimming, that's all. it's like what happens is a natural unfolding. It's like things just start happening naturally. Things start happening in the universe or in our conditions where you just think, oh, I stepped out and now the universe has provided this opportunity for me to grow. Or it could be we get a sense in ourselves of like, well, maybe we're meditating, but we're not having to try so hard anymore. It's like there's something that's just trying to say, oh, look, just open. It's trying to help us unfold. So usually the experience is something of like something outside us, but it can also be, it's like our own potential announcing itself and saying, look, I'm trying to burst into flower here. Like I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to open. And yeah, it's like a seed that's like naturally trying to grow towards the light. And so then we can just start trusting our intuition and trusting the direction that we naturally think is the right one, because it is part of this Dharma Niyama, these processes that lead to awakening, where actually like there's a level where us as conscious agent makes sense, and there's another level where it just does not make sense to see us as separate from everything else. And you know, why would we ever act in a way that harmed or was unaware? It's like that just wouldn't happen. So the whole point of ethics is to get us into the swim so that then it all just starts happening by itself and we just have to let it. But there's quite a bit of swimming needed, and actually like I think usually the swimming and the unfolding needed. Yeah, keep swimming. Good. Right, okay. So now we're going to do the key features of Buddhist ethics. So one is intention. Sorry, Lorna, just going to sit in your lap. To read it out. Okay, so I've already used this term skillful and unskillful. Typically, like one can think of ethics as doing things right or doing things wrong, but that's not really a Buddhist perspective. So, from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha taught much more about acting in a way that was skillful. So that means, so we had a tree surgeon here recently, and he was cutting down half of our weeping ash, which was fallen. And he had a chainsaw off his belt, and he was hanging off a rope, and he was kind of like flying around in this tree like Tarzan, and then kind of like holding this thing that was going to cut his own leg off if he got it wrong. And it's just like, it was just so beautiful. The level of skill of this guy was just exquisite. And so skillful is trying to get over that sense that it's like we're acting in a way that is in line with reality, and also it indicates this is something that can be learned. It's a skill we all can learn. It's nothing to do with being good or bad. You can learn it. So then what makes an action skillful or unskillful? It's the intention behind it, the mental state. So actions that of our body or our speech or our mind that come from love, awareness, generosity, those are in line with interconnectedness. And any action that is coming from ignorance or greed or ill will, those aren't in line with reality. We're not seeing interconnectedness.
So that's going to be a key thing when we're looking in groups. So every time we're asking ourselves, well, Buddhist ethics, we're always thinking, well, what was the mental state behind this action? That's the thing we come back to again and again. What was my intention? Okay, what else have we got? Okay, natural, marvellous. Okay. So Buddhist ethics are natural in the sense of there's not an authority somewhere else that says you've got to behave like this or else you'll be punished later. I run an outreach group in West Wales, and I do a beginner's course there, and I've done this session on ethics a number of times where you get people to bring to mind someone they admire. Then you get them to write on pieces of paper qualities that they admire in that person. And then you do this bit of kind of like massaging where they all naturally fall into the five precepts. And what it is like naturally all of us admire and resonate with love, generosity, contentment rather than greed. Truthfulness and authenticity rather than lying and falseness, and awareness rather than escapism or ignorance. And then those groups of people, it's like they have invented the precepts themselves. So it's like, it's not like it's someone out there, it's more like, well, who do we want to be? If we check in with our own authenticity, actually, when we're true to who we really are, actually we are expressing ethics. So we can always check in inwards. Okay. Yes, and training precepts rather than rules. I'm going to do the workshop on this, but simply to say that the five precepts, they're not absolutes. It's not like you can ever go, oh, tick, yep, done the first precept, that's me sorted. So it's like they're training, and we are capable of training ourselves. We can train to behave more ethically rather than thinking, I've got it right, aren't I great? They've got it wrong. Or else, I've got it wrong, I'm this terrible person, I failed. And, but they're so fantastic over there. It's like we're just engaged in training our minds, and we start wherever we are, and then we think, okay, what's the training that I need to put in place now? Okay then, so I'm just going to finish with, well, why would we practice ethics? Why would we practice ethics? And I've got three areas why we would practice ethics. So first, it's like, well, why would we practice ethics? Well, for our own sake. Because, as the Buddha said, if we want a happy mind, act skillfully. I mean, the Dalai Lama says, if you want to be happy, practice compassion. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. So actually, it's like the best way for us to be happy is if we are acting in line with interconnectedness, and that looks like behaving according to the five precepts. So it might be quite interesting to talk in groups if we have actually seen any change in how we feel according to whether we're acting ethically or unethically in different areas. Because it does actually set... Basically, we know interconnectedness on a deep level. So if we're acting against that, it sets up a lot of internal tension, stress and painfulness, even if we're not aware of it. it's very painful internally to act unethically. We can become sensitive to that. Yes. Then we've got ethics for the sake of others. All of us are alive in this world. We are all having an impact in the world. Shantideva in the Bodhicharya Avatara, you know, talks about like no suffering belongs to anyone, and also no happiness belongs to anyone. Can I think that if I want to be well and happy and live in a living, beautiful environment, I also want others to be able to be well and happy and live in a beautiful environment? So we've got this whole sort of compassion aspect. And here I think it's just so important to keep in touch with the sense of our own positive effect in the world. So it might be as simple as, I used to work as a physiotherapist in the NHS, and I went into work one morning, and there was this woman that I worked with who'd been coming to work. She'd got into work really late, and she'd got in a traffic jam, and she rocks up on the ward really late, and she came up to me and she said, "Look, you know what happened? And she'd been stuck in this traffic jam for an hour coming from Leeds to Sheffield. And she was getting really frustrated and she was getting really angry. And then she said, and I thought, what would Ginny do? And that was my name before I got ordained. And she said, so I thought, what would Ginny do? And I opened the windows wide and I turned the radio up and I sang. And I kind of thought, well, I don't think I'd have done anything like that myself. It's like I've been practicing about 2 years at that point, and it wasn't like I was turning up on the hospital ward and saying, have you heard what the Buddha said? have you heard the good news? That was not what I was doing. As far as I was concerned, what I was modelling was a rather stressed physiotherapist. But yet, there was something that my friend Emma had obviously picked up from how I was, where she'd thought, I have a choice here, I could make a creative decision. So basically it's like, we can see the effect the Buddha had on Angulimala, but actually we are all having an effect on people all the time. Don't underestimate that. And if you spot that, notice it. And notice the effect other people have on you, because that'll be the effect you're having on other people, if you see what I mean. So there's that side to things. And also like the conscious ethical decisions. Tara Loka has been a fair trade retreat centre for 5 years now, and a lot of our dry goods and stuff like that we get from, fair trade places. And it's like, we'll never know what the effect of that is. But, hopefully the reed rowers who are able to send their children to school and have clean water because people like us choose to buy the fair trade stuff. There'll be rice growers that have a better quality of life. But actually, reflect on it, like imagine it. If you buy fair trade chocolate, like imagine what the effect could be on the fact that you've made that choice. So get connected with positive choices. And then the final reason for practicing ethics, for their own sake, because it is beautiful. So the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, be quick to do what is morally beautiful. And sometimes it's like you just can't see what effect things are going to have in the world. It's like you're not in touch with what effect they're going to have on you. You don't really know if they're going to have an effect in the world. But it's like at that point, well, for a start, we can have trust in the law of karma. So it's like any action that is based in love and kindness is going to have an effect. We can just trust to that. But also, it's like we can also do things just because it is beautiful and that is how we want to be. So, like Tara Loka, we get green electricity here and it is more expensive. But in a way, it's like, and I don't know, if Tara Loka choosing to get green electricity will make any difference to climate change or not. And I don't care. because actually it is a beautiful action. It's like, well, who do we want to be here? You know, we want to be living in line with those values of love and caring and, you know, generosity to everything. And it is a beautiful action to get green electricity, regardless, so for its own sake. There's enough ugliness in the world. We can just act out of beauty. And actually, when we practice ethics for its own sake, what happens is that we do become aligned with Dharma Niyama processes. And it's like that kind of bigger sense of, you know, the universe wanting awakening to happen. Like that does just sort of like waken up in us if we are acting in alignment with it. It's kind of like magic, actually. You just have to kind of go with it and then see what happens. I'm just going to finish by the quote from the Dhammapada about trusting the law of karma. You know, what's so lovely about this is you can see that it's like in the Buddha's day, it was just the same. People were thinking, but there's my own self-interest. Shouldn't I be looking to that? You know, is it, you know, should I be trusting in the law of karma? Do not underestimate good, thinking it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the wise person, little by little, fills themselves with good. Do not underestimate evil, thinking it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the spiritually immature person, little by little, fills themselves with evil. Now I think we should drink tea.